Welcome to the Lawyer Education Series. My name is Katie Kelso and I'm the Solicitor in Charge of Care and Protection at Legal Aid New South Wales. I acknowledge the traditional owners of the land that I am on, land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I pay my respects to Elders past and present. I also acknowledge the traditional owners of the land from which you are listening today. Today I'm lucky to be joined by Nicola Callender, who is the Solicitor Advocate at Legal Aid New South Wales, and Leanne Wells, who is a sole practitioner. Both Nicola and Leanne are incredibly experienced at representing children in care proceedings in the Children's Court, District Court and Supreme Court. Welcome to you both and thanks for joining me today to talk about meeting with children. Now listeners will already have watched our video about representing children, so they will be very familiar with their obligations under the Act in relation to meeting with children and their obligations to ensure that children's wishes are before the court. So today I want to focus more on the practical aspects of meeting with children, with two very experienced practitioners who will be able to give us some tips so that both you as the lawyer and the child get as much out of your meetings as possible. So I also want to do a quick plug for one of our newest but most comprehensive resources, the Care and Protection Working with Children, a guide to best practice for children's legal representatives. That's a guide that looks at meeting with children, communicating with children, and guiding children through the court proceedings. Nicola, I'm going to start with this very important question. Why is it so important to communicate with the children that we represent?
Well, that's what we're appointed by the court to do. We are the only independent voice for children in care and protection proceedings. We don't get involved in casework decisions and we don't have casework relationships with family members. And so we're there as an independent voice for children. Children can feel very confused and disempowered by really important decisions being made about them, which they don't have a say in unless we are communicating with them. It's very important to communicate with them about the proceedings, what's happening in the proceedings, the various stages of proceedings, to explain our role and to let them know that they have agency and a voice about very important decisions being made about them.
Is it your view that it's important to have an ongoing relationship with children?
Very important. The research shows that most children want an ongoing relationship with their lawyer. There is some concern, I think, with lawyers about children being over-interviewed or meeting with too many people. There used to be a conversation about something colloquially called systems abuse, which was about children meeting too many people and having to repeat their story too many times with too many professionals. I think that our role is very unique. It's an informative role. We facilitate children's participation in a very important proceeding. We're not a clinical role. We're not eliciting information from a child. We're not seeking a therapeutic relationship with a child. So we are there for the child. And I think that it's incredibly important to have that ongoing relationship. Sometimes children won't disclose very much to you. I think Leanne's going to talk about building rapport, which takes time, and children will often disclose more as they get to know you, which is obviously a natural part of a relationship process, and they may change their minds, and so it's important to let the relationship evolve as more information comes to hand about the proceedings. And it's very respectful, I think, to remain in a relationship with the child throughout their proceedings. And of course, as a DLR, you have to, because you can't appear for a child unless you're instructed, and those instructions have to remain relevant throughout a proceeding. So you need to have an ongoing relationship right until the explanation of the final decision.
And we'll go on to talk a little bit more about this particular aspect, but I think it's important for our listeners to know that meeting with children, I guess, doesn't have to be the traditional coming in to chat in an office all of the time, does it? I mean, it could be by email, by telephone. There are other ways that you can do that at various points in proceedings, but we'll get to talk a bit more about that in a bit. I'm going to throw over to Leanne. Now, good preparation before meeting with the children is really important, isn't it, Leanne? Do you want to talk us through how you prepare for an interview with a child?
Sure, Katie. The first thing that I do is contact the departmental lawyer and I ask them to provide me with a contact telephone number for the child. It's important that you have the caseworker explain to the carer who I am and what my role is and that they should expect a call from me, either to set up to speak to a child in person or to speak to them over the telephone. They need to know that when I speak with the child, it's okay for me to do that alone without the carer being present. And in fact, that's the appropriate way for that to occur.
In terms of the form of the interview, can you tell us a little bit about how you approach that?
The next thing that I try and do is think about what I want to achieve out of the meeting. Sometimes, and particularly at the first instance, it's about meeting the child and letting them know that they have a lawyer, if they have any questions, to be there to answer the questions for them. Some children are young and are busy and are not that interested in the process, but some children, the older children I find, like to know who is it that's going to be in the courtroom, what sorts of things are you talking about, and you need to give them a little bit more information about what's happening behind the scenes that they're not a part of.
Now, Leanne, I just want to pick up on a point that you made earlier. Sometimes even with the best planning and making sure that you've indicated to everybody that it's really important that you are able to meet with the child that you represent on their own, sometimes your best laid plans go out the window. We've all had scenarios where we have had a carer, a parent, at the time of the appointment, try and come into the appointment with the child with you. Can you give the listeners some tips on how to deal with that type of a situation?
Yeah, so the focus needs to be on the child, obviously. We don't want to create a situation where there's conflict that the child is having to observe between yourself and the person that you're speaking with. What I would perhaps do is say to them, well, I'm happy for you to come in while we have an initial meet and greet and I explain what my role is. And then it's very important that I talk to the child on their own so I can ascertain what their views are and what their wishes are. But if you have any questions for me or there's anything you'd like to tell me afterwards, perhaps we can organise a meeting between ourselves after that.
That's a good strategy.
Nicola, do you have any comments on that?
I agree that that is a very good strategy, and I think it goes to Leanne's point before about the importance of preparation. So when you're making that, when you're organising the interview or the meeting with the child, you're really clear about what's going to happen so the person isn't that confusion when they arrive. But if there is, then I think that's a very good strategy. I think the other strategy is simply to, strategy is to let the carer know how long you're going to be, where the child's going to be, what the circumstances of the meeting is, and that the child will know where they are and about the approximate time you think the meeting might take, so that you give them some reassurance as well about the meeting. And then I have on occasion stepped aside with the carer and explained to them about the kinds of pressures the child is under with all of the different agendas relevant to the child at that time, and how very important it is that they have a space where they can just be and express what they need to express that's entirely private and confidential. And that's had some success some of the time, and not so that's another strategy if you get a bit desperate and perhaps can't get them out of the room, or you're simply not winning that conversation.
So I think that emphasises the importance of being flexible and adaptable when you're doing these types of things. And sometimes I think the approach that I've had to use when all else has failed is to have a quick meeting, talk about some non-controversial issues and then make a further appointment at a later time when perhaps the messaging's a bit clearer. Leanne, I just want to pick up on something that Nicola spoke about earlier, which is, as she termed it, what systems abuse. And so I think that the clear message around that is that it's really important to meet with kids, even though there might be concerns about how it will impact upon them. And I think that leads us into talking about support for children. There are going to be children that have experienced trauma that are going to find this a really, really difficult process. Good preparation will mean that you've read the documents and hopefully you're on top of what those issues might be for children. What do you kind of do if you think that a child is going to need some extra support in the context of meeting with you?
Certainly there are experts available that may be necessary to bring into the meeting. I'm a lawyer, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a counsellor, and whilst I've certainly obtain a lot of information about how best to deal with children in difficult circumstances, I think sometimes we do need to rely on some external supports, particularly in matters that are extremely distressing for children. I had one matter that I was involved in where the child was having photos taken of her by the mother and by the mother's partner, and there was a suggestion of some child prostitution that was planned. The difficulty in that matter was that the child wanted to talk about it, wanted to know what was going on, needed to understand why she wasn't with her mother. And in those circumstances, we organised for the department to pay for Jenny Howell, an independent person, to come in who could prepare the child before the meeting, be present during the meeting, and then do some debriefing after the meeting with the child as well.
Mm. That's a really good strategy and something for people to keep in mind. And I think being across the material in terms of knowing whether children have treaters and how soon their next appointment might be after seeing you, or making sure that they're appropriately supported, I think all flows into that issue. Nicola, is there anything that you want to add in terms of good preparation for meeting with children, just in terms of looking at a child's background, I guess, and background information?
I think it's very important to learn about the child's cultural background in preparation for the meeting, and find out about their language and their level of communication skills. Are there supports that the child might need in order for you to be able to facilitate a meeting with them? Do they have a disability, for example? And with Indigenous children, Torres Strait Islander children, are there ways that you can acknowledge how their culture and ask questions, appropriate questions about how they live their culture? Find out about their relationship with community and where they're from, when their people are from. That may not be available to you in those initial meetings, but it's something that you and the young person could perhaps explore together. Exposure to some Aboriginal art, doing some drawings. One of the things Leanne emphasises is doing the artwork with kids, and most kids love to draw and those sorts of things.
And that leads us perfectly into the next topic, which is about the actual process of interviewing with children and how you go about building rapport with different children. Have you got any tips or techniques that you like to use when you're meeting with kids?
Yep. So just like me as an adult going to a meeting can be anxious and nervous about what's going to occur, it's even more scary for a child who has no idea about what's going to occur and has a grown-up that they're going to have to speak to. I find it's helpful to find something that the child might be interested in. For example, they might be wearing a t-shirt with a character on it, and then you can talk about that particular character for a moment. Or Mark Whelan in particular has a picture of his dog Holly on his phone, and he likes to show the children pictures of Holly or videos of Holly spinning, chasing her tail, which lightens the mood a bit. It gets the children talking about their own pets and about things that are safer topics to talk about, and then they feel more happy to talk to you about the more serious things.
Mm. Can I just add to that also the importance of just really practical things, such as thinking about where the child has come from? Have they travelled a distance? Have they been at school all day? Do they need to know where the bathroom is, for example? Would they like a drink of water? And then there's just simple things like stepping out from behind your desk. You know, children... we are in the legal profession, we're often suited up, maybe take your jacket and tie off, perhaps take your high heels off and come down. We have child-friendly rooms at Legal Aid, so we're fortunate in that we have a space that's already set up with soft toys, books. The Best for Kids video, if you can show that to kids, can sometimes be quite a nice introduction. But certainly think about the furnishings in your room sort of being much more on their level and... cutting the formality out of the situation a little bit, really practical
thing. Even doing things like moving chairs around and setting rooms up in a little bit more of a friendly way, not sitting behind a computer, those types of things are all ways that you can sort of make it a little bit more child-friendly. Now, the last one, which you've both picked up on, is about colouring in, and I think it flows into setting a room up so that it's a space where children can feel comfortable. Colouring in, how do you use colouring in when you're meeting with kids?
So I think trying to take the situation away from being how we as adults interview parents, I think it's important to try and become a part of the children's space and about what they would normally have done within their afternoon time. So colouring in is something that I found that most younger children in particular enjoy doing. I like to print off things that they can colour. For example, one of the issues that I use is a castle. It may be that we have a picture of a castle and we're colouring that in together, and then I say, oh, now pretend that you're a princess, having you think through the important people in your life, who would you have live in your castle? And then we might have a discussion about, well, what about the people that might live in the village but come and visit at your castle? Who would those people be? And then sometimes we move on to, well, is there someone who you wouldn't even want in your village and you really don't want to be a part of that? That gives you some ideas about, not a psychological analysis, but it gives you some ideas about who important people are to a child and on face value who is scary to them.
And a nice little tip that certainly, look, I've done my fair share of drawing with kids is letting them take a copy of what they've done home with them. And I also like to say to them, look, I think I'm going to put this up in my office. Is it okay if I take a copy? And the general consensus is that that's very well received, to know that their artwork is going to go up in your office and they can take a copy home for the care or their parents. So, Nicola, do you have any comments to make on colouring or using colouring?
No, I wouldn't have anything to add except I agree. I sometimes take the picture back to my, if I have another face-to-face interview, I take the picture with me and you can talk about it and then you can expand on it. And kids are just chuffed that you've made that connection with them, I think. That's a lovely example of Castle.
I think that's a great one. Now, Leanne, I'm just going to talk to you about what you might be able to get out of the interview with a child. It's, of course, it's an opportunity to understand a child's views, but it's about other things as well, isn't it? There are other things that you can find out from a child that's going to really benefit them. Do you want to talk us through some of those things from your perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. So when a child's removed from their parents, they're generally picked up and taken with sometimes just a bag of clothes, nothing else. I think it's important time, particularly when I first speak to a child, to say, is there anything that you need at the moment? Do you have enough school clothes? Do you have enough books? Do you have enough furniture? Because whilst the department is setting them up in that new home, it's important that they have everything that's important to them. One example that I had was a teenage girl who said, look, what I really need is an eyebrow wax. And we managed to convince the department that that was something that was important to make her feel better and needed to occur, and they were happy to oblige.
Mm, that's a really good tip. What about other things that you might be able to learn through an interview? You're gathering information for yourself. Can you explain what you might mean by that?
So another thing that I can obtain out of an interview is other possible family placements or friends that could potentially be involved in a child's life. Parents who have got their own agenda will only give family members who suit the particular cause that they're after. But I find sometimes by talking to children that there are other family members who are distant to this immediate family who may actually present a placement option for a child. Or it may be distant relatives that you wouldn't have thought of, or a family friend that you wouldn't have thought of or known of from the court material, who does play an important part in that child's life, and they want to have regular contact with Auntie Sue, for example, who's not necessarily an auntie but someone who's been important to the family.
And is it fair to say that in the vast majority of cases you're going to be seeing children in offices, or perhaps even sometimes less frequently in other locations? Sometimes you might have no choice for particular circumstances to see a child in a placement. What do you think in particular you can learn from attending a placement?
I think an important part of going to a child's home is it gives you an opportunity to suss out what that home environment's like. That may raise some risk issues to you. It also gives you an opportunity to meet the carer and to try and understand what sort of capacity that particular person has. It lets you know how many other children are in the home. Often that's not something that's in the material. And it gives you some of an idea about the environment and the way that that particular family live. I also find it important to be able to see a connection between a child and their siblings or other children in the placement, because, again, sometimes we focus on that there are two children that are a party to these proceedings, but there may actually be other children in the placement or natural children of the carer who those children have become close to, and they're important relationships to take into account as well.
Mm. And Nicola, do you just want to comment from a safety perspective about issues with attendance in terms of placement? Are there things that you would do if you did find yourself really with no other way to go and see a child? How would you keep yourself safe?
Importantly, that you let either a colleague or, in the case of legal aid, solicitors, your supervisor know exactly where you're going, what the address is, how long you think you're going to be there, and maybe check in with them when you're leaving to let them know that you're safe. And I think for panel practitioners, private practitioners, I think let a friend or a colleague know exactly the same information and check in with them when you're on the road. Can I just add something also to what Leanne was saying about how you inform yourselves? I think sometimes we really question the value of seeing very young children. And as a very wise colleague said to me recently, there's a huge amount of difference between going to a hospital or going to a home and seeing a malnourished, sickly, disengaged little baby and a bubbly, well-nourished, chubby little baby. And it tells you an enormous amount of information about the child that you're representing. Mm. And I think with very young children, that connection, which Leanne has referred to a number of times with the carers, is incredibly important. It's very important that carers know who we are and what our role is, because we are there to be a representative of the child who is too young to represent themselves. And there may be things the carers are not able to negotiate with the department or need support to understand. And while we don't give them advice, obviously, we are there for the child. So that's an important relationship with very young children.
And I think certainly there's been situations where when I have represented perhaps a sibling group or even just a really small child, that there are other ways that you can see a child. It's not necessarily the case that you might have to have a carer come to the office and sight the child. You might see the child as part of a sibling group and just be able to see them. But also I've had matters where I've been at court and the carer has come along with the child and I've been able to go and have a little say hello to a small child. So think outside the box a little bit with it as well. Now, Nicola, I just want to touch upon one of the other really important reasons that it's important to meet with children, and one of the other things that that it's really important to suss out in those meetings, and that's around capacity. And that's going to be particularly relevant for children as they get a little bit older. And you want to talk us through what you might be sort of sussing out in a meeting about children's capacity.
Yes, it is important. One of the really important reasons for meeting with, apart from obviously you have to get instructions, but with children who are 12 years and over, is that you may form a view that a child doesn't have capacity to give you proper instructions. And if you do that, then you have an obligation to make an application to the court to be an independent children's legal representative for that child, or for a guardian to be appointed. If you do that, it's a very significant step, because you're taking away that child's right or young person's right to instruct you. And so it needs to be made, needs to be well considered, and it needs to be based ideally on some psychological or medical evidence to support the basis of your application.
And am I right to say that it works the other way as well? In children that may be 10 or 11, when you're meeting with them, it might be the application that you might want to make then is that you become a direct legal representative?
Yes, absolutely. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. If you have a 10 or 11-year-old who's well-informed, they're articulate, they have very clear views about what they want and how they understand their care arrangements, you might make that application. It's also important to be aware that a child who's 11 may well turn 12 during proceedings, and you might find that you have to cease to represent them because a DLR is to be appointed, and you find yourself in a difficult position in terms of then needing to act on instructions. Mm-hmm. So, yes.
Leanne, the next question is for you, and I think this is probably more relevant for our direct legal representatives, but also children of the age of about 10 or 11, perhaps even younger, depending upon the child. Can you give us some tips about taking instructions? Because when we're meeting with children, we're not going to conduct ourselves in the same way as we would if we were meeting with an adult necessarily, are we?
No, that's right. I think it's important when you talk to a child that not only are you telling them that you're keen to hear what their wishes might be, but it's important that you don't set up any expectations. One particular example I have recently is that I was given a care plan which proposed a restoration of a child, or a group of siblings in fact, to a mother. The child, when speaking to me, was absolutely over the moon about that plan and said, well, give me a date. When am I going to go home? And I had to be very clear with that child to say, at the moment, this is just the department's plan, and that there are lots of different people that are involved in the proceedings. But most importantly, the judge has to make the final decision. So until the judge says it's safe for you to go home, that can't happen. So I can't give you any promises that you'll be going home now. And it turned out to be important that I did that because, unfortunately, at the DRC the next day, the mother told the court that she had decided she'd rather stay in a relationship with the father, who was not a part of that restoration plan, than have the children come home to her.
Mm. Now, one of the other things that you will often need to do when you're meeting with children is, particularly when you're on direct instructions, is reality test what their instructions to you are going to be. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about that and also how you use your plan A and your plan B?
Yes, certainly. So lots of children say, I want to go home to mum and dad. That's quite common. Even if they've been through horrific circumstances, their underlying drive is, I want to go home to my mum and my dad. And I think it's important, just like what we do with adults, when they say, well, this is what I would like to achieve out of the proceedings, we have to say to the child, well, that may not happen. I do that by explaining that the ultimate decision is the judge's decision, and the judge is there to make sure that you're safe. And as you understand that you were taken away from mum and dad because you were not safe at that time, and so perhaps it may not be safe right now for you to go home. And we talk about what, on a child-focused, age-appropriate level, what it might be that might not be safe for them to go home.
Mm-hmm.
Alternatively, if it's a slightly older child who's quite adamant that they want to go home, sometimes I also go through with them and say, well, what would you do if you went home and then things turned out not to be safe? You know, do you have a plan about that? Who would you call? Could you speak to your teacher? Can you speak to the caseworker? Who would you tell if you did go down that path and it didn't work?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's important that they have in the back of their mind that that if something does go wrong, who is it that they ask for help? Because in those circumstances, it's not going to be the mother or the father they've been restored to.
And in terms of that reality testing, Leanne, is using the plan A as being what they would absolutely like to happen primarily, and plan B a good way to do it in the sense that you're sort of reality testing and you're ensuring that you're providing that legal advice in a way that a child can understand, but also flagging with them to think through what they might want if they don't get plan A? Is that part of the process?
That's right. So what I say to them is, let's make a bit of a list. So in an ideal world, you're saying to me you'd like to go home to mum or to dad, and that's plan A. What would plan B be? If the judge says that it's not safe and you can't go home to mum and dad, then what would you like to have happen? And then further on, if that can't happen, then what would your next option be? And I find usually if you've got, for example, three different options, it helps the child understand that there's a little bit of a priority that we're working through and that something might not be possible, but something else might be possible. I also find it helpful because sometimes in matters, an adult, the parent, for example, might say, well, I don't want this particular thing to happen, and that may cause your plan A to fall out the window. You don't want to have to then keep ringing that child up every time that the mother changes her instructions on what she wants. If I've got a plan of, well, if that can't happen, this is the next plan, and if that can't happen, this is the next plan, it saves me having to ring the child constantly.
And so that makes it easier also for you, but also for the child, most importantly, to not continually have to, you know, rethink, I guess, what they want. I mean, there may obviously be circumstances where that has to happen, but if you've got those sort of plans, that's a really good tool for people to use.
I think it's really important what Leanne has set out there, and I think that as DLRs, we have an obligation to really do some quite robust reality testing with young people. And one of the important things to my mind is there's a lot of subpoenaed material often, subpoenas are often issued in these proceedings, and I think it's really useful to read that. Even if the outcome of a proceeding seems quite inevitable, you can learn a huge amount about a child, which assists you in that reality testing around the reality, because sometimes they'll only give you quite select information because that's how they view the world because of their age and stage of development. So the broader the picture that you can get, the more that you can assist them with those alternatives. And I also think the way Leanne has set out asking children around, well, if you couldn't have your ideal world, what next, allows the child to actually, it sort of helps the child to think about, what would I want if I couldn't live with mum and dad? And that's where you'll sometimes get that they start to think about suggestions around a family that they could live with, or around a coach, or around some important person, because of the way you're framing that or those alternatives. And also I think around those conversations, well, if you did live with mum, what are the things that would need to change, that you would like to change? And then, so if mum, you know, perhaps if mum went and got some help around her drinking. Would that make it even better if you went home so that you can talk to them, that assists as well? And then that helps with the conversation about why they might not be able to go home because those things haven't happened yet. Mm-hmm. So it's I think you have to be quite robust in those sorts of conversations, particularly with older children.
These can be incredibly difficult conversations to have with kids, and I think that emphasises, again, that need to not constrain yourself to just having one meeting with a child. You might need to say to a child, have a think and we'll talk about it again soon, and making sure you don't give a child just one opportunity to tell you such important information about what the rest of their life might look like for them. So, Nicola, one of the really important things is that children are able to keep in touch with you throughout proceedings. Do you want to talk to us about how you make sure that a child knows how to get in touch with you and how you can make sure that relationship is still there even though you might not have seen the child in a while?
Clearly that depends on the age of the child, and with young children, clearly you're dependent on caseworkers and carers to assist in that regard. So you need to make sure that they have your contact details, and that that they know that if a child asks to contact you, that provide them with your email address and your telephone numbers. You can talk to kids about whether they have a mobile phone, if they have an email address. If you do have an email address, you need to check who else has access to that email address. And so it may well be that they make contact with you by email, and then you make an arrangement to ring them and speak with them privately. So it depends entirely on what technology the child has available to them, their capacity to manage that technology. The important thing is that they know that your contact details, and they know that they are free to communicate with you whenever they want to.
Leanne, do you have anything you want to add to that? I mean, certainly my strategy with the children that I represent is to provide them with a copy of my card and write down what details I want them to have specifically on the back. Sometimes that's my direct line, and I often say to them, you know, you're really special because I don't give this just to anybody. Have you got some techniques that you use?
I think most of the time the communication is set up through the carer. So I usually say, your carer has my telephone number and your caseworker has my telephone number. If you think of something after today that you would like to talk to me about, or that if you change your mind about something, then by all means give me a ring or send me a text, or when I finish at court I can give you a call.
Okay, so we're going to talk now about post-interviews with kids. When we're thinking about how we're going to make sure that a child's wishes is put before the court, Leanne, do you want to walk us through some of the things to be mindful of when you're thinking about what you might file, if you might file something, what all of that might look like?
Sometimes when you're acting for children and you speak to them or you attend their home, there are some concerns that you may have, either about cleanliness, about safety, about wishes. Those are important things that need to be communicated, but they don't necessarily need to be communicated through the form of a court document. I have seen some lawyers filing wishes statements for three-month-old babies. That's not a wishes statement. It may be your concern or your observations, and if you have those concerns or there's something that you'd like to put to the parties, then I say that should occur via an email. There are more appropriate ways of that happening rather than you filing it in what you call a wishes statement.
Because it's important to remember what your role is in these proceedings, isn't it? And to be mindful of the fact that these court documents mean something, and it could be that somebody asks that you be cross-examined on the contents of a document. You need to be really careful that you're not making yourself a witness in these proceedings, because the flow and effect of that for children as well is that obviously you won't be their legal representative anymore. Some of the other things to think about in terms of what you might put in a wishes statement if you do file them is who gets them.
That's right. Sometimes when you're speaking to a child, they might be particularly angry at their mum or their dad or the department or someone who's been involved in the recent events in their life. But be mindful that their mum or their dad or the caseworker is in fact also going to get a copy of this document. It's something that's going to go on the file and it's going to stay on that court file. It's very important that you keep in mind that they're going to continue to have contact with the people that you may be writing upsetting things about. So the way that you articulate that, or whether it even needs to be in that particular document, really needs to be carefully thought through.
Now, this is a question for you both, and you might want to reflect upon your own experiences. Have there been scenarios where you have decided not to meet with a child? Do you want to explore that a little bit? What if you have decided not to meet with a child, what were the circumstances, or what were the circumstances in which you might think about not meeting with a child?
I have reflected on this quite a lot, and I can't think of a situation where I wouldn't initially meet with a child. I might form a view, and I have formed a view in one case that I can remember where a sibling group was living with a particularly difficult carer, and it became apparent to me that those children, that the level of distress that them coming to see me was causing the children because of the carer's distress, and that really they were not able, because of the dynamics in that family, to express a view any different from everybody in that family, which were the carer's views. They didn't have permission to express a different view. And I found after about three meetings that over a lengthy litigation that it was pointless, and in fact it was creating more distress. So I started to communicate with those children in writing, and I provided them with quite concrete information about what was happening, which was completely just not controversial at all. And I really met with them again at the end of the proceedings to explain why the decisions had been made that had been made. But generally, I get so much information out of that first meeting that I can't think of a situation where I have not met a child.
Leanne, can you think of an example where you haven't met with a child, or where you might seriously think about not meeting with a child?
Yes, there have certainly been circumstances where I haven't met with children. Sometimes in cases a lot of pressure is put on the child and what their wishes are. And I think to some extent it's important that we make it clear that this case isn't determined on what that child's wishes are. Even if that child has a strong wish, that can be obtained in other ways as well. I've got one matter that I'm thinking of in particular where there were multiple caseworkers that spoke to this child all the time. We had multiple psychologists involved. Her wishes were well and truly known. She had told everybody, everyone knew what was happening, and I just did not see the utility in another person asking her the same thing. It was clear in every single time that people spoke with her, she was only young, and I didn't see the benefit in me being another person to ask her the same question again. Mm.
So I'm just going to move on to some of the tricky issues that can sometimes arise when we're representing children. I think this next question is really about when you're representing a child as a direct legal representative. And I think it's a difficult topic. Access to court documents. Nicola, do you want to talk about that in terms of how you manage that with children who are on direct instructions?
It's a very vexed issue because the documentation often contains extremely sensitive material about the young person and their family. And so you really need to think carefully about the extent to which it's in their best interest to have access to that material. However, you're on instructions, and so they may well instruct you that they want that material, which puts you in a very difficult position. There are lots of ways to negotiate that. You can read through it with them and be careful. You can talk to them about the reality of what they will do with those documents and talk through some of the realities of the documents perhaps ended up in their school bag or how they're going to keep them safe. And failing being able to convince them that they shouldn't have them. I think Leanne was speaking earlier about cases that she's been in where she's actually, the secretary's made an application to the court.
Leanne, that might be a good time to talk to you. How do you manage that situation when you've got kids that want to see the court documents and they're entitled to see those documents?
Yep. So first of all, when I'm meeting with the child, I explain to them that there are court papers. And what I usually say is those court papers are very long and they can be quite boring, quite tedious. If you like, I can summarise them for you. And most children are happy to accept a summary rather than me having to hand over the documents. In matters, though, where the children are adamant that, no, I want that paperwork, then what I, in my own practice, have done is notified the department and the other parties that I've spoken to the child about it, that they are insisting that they be given the court paperwork, and that as their direct legal representative, I'm compelled to give them the document unless an order is made otherwise. And in those matters, I have had the department or other parties raise it with the court, and the court make an order that they didn't need to be served with the material.
So do you think that you have to use your own judgment in matters like that as to whether that's a matter where you would raise that with the parties, or whether you would think about the way that you might be able to take the child through those documents with your assistance or with the assistance of somebody else?
Yes, I do. Raising concerns with the court should be a last resort if you can avoid it. If you can come up with a plan that will make the child happy, give them the information they want in a safe way, where we're not creating extra issues, I think is the best course.
And just thinking that through, if there was any suggestion that popping court documents attached to a letter to a child, would either of you have any opinions about that in the post?
I would just never do it. They're just such sensitive documents. And not only they're sensitive to the child, they also have the identity of other children and other people. You simply don't know where they're going to be received, who they're going to be received by, what safety mechanisms are at the other end for the management of those documents. And you really isolate, you're really abrogating all responsibility for the management of that information with the child that you represent. Leanne might have something to add, but can I also just say, I think this also goes into the conversation. You know, some kids are really keen to come to court, and I think that comment about, court can be really boring, you know, you have to sit around all day. It's much more fun, it's much more fun at school. You sit around all day, you might only just get into court for 5 minutes, a whole lot of stuff happens, and then you come out again. So that's one of the ways I sometimes manage it when children really, really want to come to court. DRCs are slightly different because you can negotiate with the registrar about perhaps children coming for a part of a DRC, and that I think can be really useful and helpful for the child and quite constructive to the process. But in terms of just an insistence, talking about how boring it is can be really helpful.
Leanne, do you have anything to add on that particular note?
Just in terms of the child wanting to come to court, I have had matters, I guess more of a Section 90 kind of situation or a proceeding that's been going for a long time, where the child has become a bit more used to the idea of court and the process and thinks, well, I'd like to come along and I want to tell the judge something. Magistrate Hogg was really good in dealing with children in those circumstances. And what we would do is I would bring the child into the courtroom and I would explain that I'm acting for Tommy and Tommy would like to tell the judge some things about what he would like to have happen, and let him do that. And then when he finished, then we had an agreement that he was going to leave and I was going to run the hearing. But that way he had his opportunity to talk to the court about what he wanted and what was important to him. And I think if children are really insistent, that sometimes that's helpful, because otherwise it is a bunch of decisions being made by adults and people who are known to the child. And I think if they've had some involvement in that process, sometimes that helps.
Mm. And I think you can have a variety of different experiences with kids. And I think this, again, highlights that you really need to take every child as every child is different, because I've had matters where I've had children come for every single court appearance, and that was able to be managed entirely appropriately, and she was fine with that. And then I've had other kids where they've come along for one appearance and then they've realised what you said about court being boring has been right, and they've not wanted to come again, and they trust you to then go and do that and come back and tell them what you've said. So I think you can really adapt what you do with each child depending upon their individual circumstances. So I just want to move on to one of the other tricky issues, and that's around what can happen when kids give you information which might mean that you become concerned about their safety. Nicola, how do you have that conversation with a child initially about what might happen in that situation?
I think it's really important when you first meet children, clearly in a developmentally appropriate way, to explain to them the limits of the confidentiality in your relationship. Because if you don't do that up front, and I recommend that you have a sort of script, if you don't do it up front, they can tell you something, they can disclose something to you, and that horse is bolted. You can't unhear something. So I think it's important to explain the limits. I think as a direct representative, your communication with a child is subject to legal professional privilege, and you have to obtain the child's consent to waive that privilege. And so you have to explain that up front. If you do hear something clearly that suggests that a child is at risk, you have an obligation to let the secretary know that. But you've got all of those ethical issues around, well, you don't want to become a witness in the case. So in my experience, I looked to find out if the child, I talked to the child about whether or not they might have told somebody else, and whether that, what the person has done with that information if they've been told. I also look to see if that information might be available somewhere else in the material. And then I would talk to the child perhaps about whether or not they'd be prepared to speak to a psychologist or their caseworker or even a trusted person at school, so that you don't end up in a situation where you are a witness and you are no longer able to be in the relationship as a representative for the child. So it's quite vexed. So you need to be clear about that up front.
Leanne, do you have any comments that you want to make about how to deal with those types of issues where there might be safety concerns or disclosures made by a child? And you know, it's obviously difficult, obviously, for the child who's disclosing something that means that they might not be safe, but it's also it puts the lawyer in a bit difficult position as well.
Yes, especially when you're an independent legal representative, because obviously you're really concerned with trying to make that child safe as your ultimate role. I've had matters where a child has explained to me that they wanted to self-harm and had a history of self-harming. So I contacted the Crown solicitors because they were the department in my matter, and they told me to make a risk of harm report. So I then had to make a risk of harm report. If you have to do that, be prepared. It takes hours. It's a bit like calling Telstra. You have to speak to four different people and give them your name and your number and tell them the story again and again and again. But be prepared and make sure you've file noted what it is that the child has said and what you're concerned about, so that you can relay that story as close as possible to what did occur. And I always explain to the child in that circumstance, well, I'm really worried about you because of what you've told me, and it's really important that we get you some help now. So I'm going to have a talk to, in that case, the workers in the home, and make sure that you're going to be safe tonight. So they were knowing that I was going to make that report and that someone would be coming and asking them about it, because I think it's important that you don't go behind their back to some extent too. They you build a bit of trust with them. They need to know, well, Leanne's there doing what I'm, you know, keeping me safe, and that's why she's telling someone, not just because I'm causing trouble.
Mm. And I think the Law Society representation principles for children's lawyers are a really, really helpful place for information about how to deal with those types of ethical issues. And also the Legal Profession Uniform Law Australian Solicitors Conduct Rules are also a very helpful place to start to look for information about what your obligations are in terms of disclosures. Now, just to wrap up, I'm going to ask both of you to give us some top tips on how to meet with children, or anything that you wished that you knew when you first started out meeting with children.
I think that's a really good idea, because I mean, I was sort of thinking I would be much less shy, you know, I'd be much less cautious and much less reticent and much more. And so I think if you have a plan, you sort of protect yourself from that, perhaps being overly sensitive to the child and not wanting to impose and not wanting to be another voice and really not quite fully understanding the role in terms of that meeting and the importance of that meeting to the child, not just to me, but to the child. So I think that plan is a great way of managing that, because if you have a plan, regardless if you're oversensitive or over shy or a bit reticent about imposing, you've got a thing you want to get through. And so you sort of support yourself to get through. So I think that's a really good idea. I think that's kind of a nice way of...
I think as a junior solicitor, one of the most important things that you can do to try and increase your skill set is to talk to people who are more experienced than you. I've got a lot of very helpful colleagues, and I think the Children's Court in particular is a forum where people are really helpful, and if you say you don't know what to do in a particular situation, people are more than willing to offer you advice and support. I have some fantastic colleagues who I go to if I say, I'm just not sure, what should I do in this situation? How would you approach this? An example being, I had two children and I was told that they were so anxious, there was no way they were going to be able to talk to me. But their wishes, unfortunately, became an important part of how this decision was going to play out. It was a decision whether they should go back to their mum, who on all facts was doing a great job of looking after a sibling and could have cared for these children, or stay with foster carers who they'd been living with for such a long time. And it came down to really where they were the most comfortable is what the outcome was going to be. So I had to talk to these children and I had to my own observation about what that was going to be. And so one of my friends suggested, why don't you take them to the park? She said, sometimes when you're sitting in a room and the carers are outside and it's all a lot of pressure and it's hard and it's stressful for these kids, sometimes if you take it out of the office to a place that's fun and they feel it's just a conversation, that you're having a chat, you're having a play, then sometimes they're more able to engage with you. So I took her dog, who is incredibly friendly, and I took a ball and I said to the carers, I found this dog-friendly park, which is not too far from your place. How about you bring the kids down and I'll have a play? That particular situation was really helpful because the carers felt confident because they could see me with the children and they knew the children were safe. The children could see the carers and again felt reassured by that, but they couldn't hear what we were saying, so the conversation was private and in no way affected by it. And because we were concentrating on throwing the ball and watching the dog get it and bring it back and whose turn it was to throw the ball next, it became a casual conversation about the dog and about life things until we then moved to something a little bit more serious. And that's when they were more than happy to talk to me about those particular things. So reach out, think outside the box.
I was just thinking that one of the lessons I have learned is to be much more careful with what children tell me. So when we talk about putting on wishes reports and I'm now hesitant out of my own experience, and my tendency is to put them on later in proceedings rather than early, because children's wishes change and circumstances change, and as you become better informed and children become better informed, their understanding about their circumstances evolves, because they may never have experienced being in a safe home before, going to school in a clean uniform, having good food, and so several months of that, what they think and how they are is entirely different from, and so I am much less gung-ho about letting people know what children have said than I used to be. I don't think I was ever gung-ho, but I'm more cautious now, more careful. Yeah.
Those are some really fantastic tips, and just thank you for joining us.